Good afternoon. Welcome to Dialogue Radio for the week beginning Sunday, the 5th of September. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. On the show today, white slavery and Bristol's use as a fortress to attack Wales. Julian Lee Jones from the Temple Local History Group tells us more. We also have an appeal for all your old photos of train lines that were closed by Dr. Beeching in the 60s. We also have some mobile phone tips and an invite to hear the new choir in the city. Other items, we hear from Luca, you may have heard from a few weeks ago, from Bulgaria, talking about the communist era in his country and what it was like.
Malcolm Greaves reads also another chapter of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. Tim Burrows is here to read us another poem, and not forgetting, of course, Jeff Sparks. He's got his What's On and the Song of the Week. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce two evangelicals from two different traditions. One was a Protestant and one Catholic. I'd like to welcome Simon and Bridget. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Simon, you may have seen, he's got a bag around him that says Jesus is the answer. And he's got it on right now, immediately. But we're here mainly sort of to chat about the difference between Protestant conversion and Catholic conversion, if you like, I guess, is one thing.
Right.
Simon, I understand you're more from a Protestant background.
Yeah, Anglican.
And you converted to what?
Born again. I got baptised as an adult.
And Bridget, you grew up as a Catholic in
Ireland.
Yeah,
I was brought up as a Catholic, and I've converted, if you like, to being a Christian.
Okay. So how long ago did you two sort of first meet each other?
Well, we met when we were asked to co-run a drop-in for the homeless about 9-10 years ago. It was quite good, actually, because we were asked to run this cafe to make money in a church hall, and a few customers came along, and Bridget was sort of in charge. And then a couple of homeless people came in, and Bridget wanted to give them free food, which we did. Mm. And then the word got around the street pretty quickly that there's free food, and they all came in, and the customers paying dropped off, and it turned into a full drop-in instead of a shop.
Okay.
And it was very successful.
Brilliant. Okay, and did you become born again after the meeting, or were you already born again already?
No, about 10 years before each of us.
Yeah. Okay, so Bridget, what was it like being brought up as a Christian in Ireland? How do you think the difference for being a Christian?
I think I more or less looked upon myself as a Catholic while I was being brought up in Ireland, and I didn't have any access to the Bible, and we were taking orders from Rome, really, which came through the Catechism, which was a book that they'd made themselves.
So a lot of people in Britain, who culturally at least might have been brought up sort of Church of England without having thought much about it, I mean, what impression did it make upon you as a child, Catholicism? Because to English eyes, seem very orthodox and quite almost theatrical somehow.
Yes, but it was more or less something we were taught, but advised not to take too seriously.
So yeah. as it would have been in Latin, I imagine obviously you didn't understand.
Not a word. And it just sort of closed my ears. And
did the adults actually understand it?
No. No one seemed to understand what was going on. We just went to church like we went to school, and we did everything else. We did our shopping. We just went to church, got seen, went home.
You told me, Bridget, that you spent half an hour in the church praying, and the teacher came in and said you were...
Yeah, she said you mustn't spend so much time in the church, because we come in for 5-3 minutes and then we go, so you must do the same. So it was a case of you couldn't be seen to be talking to God or praying to him outside that Latin thing.
Seems quite strange.
Yeah, it was very strange, because she said you'll be looked upon as a religious freak, so you must just do as we are doing, follow us, and everything will be fine. But of course I couldn't.
Okay. What were your fellow children... Your family, friends and sort of things like that?
Well, we were very isolated, because it was very class distinction all around.
Okay, so whereabouts in Ireland did you grow up?
Southern Ireland, County Westmeath.
So did you often find that, did you have conversations with your friends at school where...
Not very much, because we weren't really encouraged to have much conversation. It was sort of, we had Gaelic, sometimes we had to speak just all Gaelic, sometimes English, and we weren't encouraged to have any sort of one-to-one.
That seemed quite strange. What do you make of that? Why do you think they were like that?
Well, I think we weren't allowed to discuss things like the Bible or what was in it or anything. It was more or less games, and everyone was like a bunch of people. There was no such thing as a one-to-one or anyone being isolated or sort of, you know, we just followed what we were told to do.
Okay, and when did you come to Britain?
1964.
Okay.
And when did you suddenly realise that a lot of people over here, say Church of England or other backgrounds, suddenly probably knew an awful lot more than you did, despite the fact that you had a relationship you felt with God for a long time?
Yeah, I felt that there was a book called The Bible, which I'd never seen, and I wasn't encouraged in Ireland to ever look at it, unless I want to end up in a mental hospital or something, that's what I was told. So I set out to find the book, and it took me a long time. Because
How do you mean it took a long time?
Well, because I didn't know what I was looking for. I'd never heard the word Bible. I'd never heard the word Jew. I didn't know there was such a place as Israel and Jews. I didn't know anything. I knew that Jesus died on the cross for sinners, and that's about as much as I got.
Right.
Yeah, so the rest was all...
So why do you think they tried to limit access to information in such a way that is so alien to the evangelical tradition? Why?
Well, we were followers. We were followers of Rome. Yeah. We weren't encouraged to think for ourselves.
Okay, so the hierarchical nature of it...
Absolutely.
...disrupts the message of it.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, and Simon, what did you make of being born again? Did you feel that your two different backgrounds meant that you had a different understanding of being born again?
Not in the least. It's like we came together, two tributaries to a river, I suppose, and joined together, and we believe exactly the same. But as Bridget said, I can help Protestants and she can help Catholics a lot, because we know, you know, each knows one side.
So Bridget, what sort of reaction did you get? Possibly, I suppose, you spoke to your family about this. They must have reacted to it, friends and family. What did they say?
Well, they were quite taken back at first. You know, the sort of... The Catholic Church had handed us down a religion which came through my forefathers. Mm. And so I was encouraged to stay with what I was handed down. Although I had spent most of my childhood trying to break away from it. And I wasn't discouraged because I thought, I've started looking into this, so I'm going to continue. And I felt I had to find out for myself, and I hadn't just got to take other people's cast-offs, religion or whatever. And so in reading the Bible, I found a deeper meaning to everything in life.
Okay.
And I found the Jews. I didn't know about them before.
Okay. What is these age brackets like for the average evangelical church? How many Jews do you have along to come along and experience it?
What we've done is evangelised the youth, street evangelism, in College Green especially. And over 3 years, you know, it's sort of gothics and teenagers down there, we had over 1,300 ask Jesus for a place in heaven. So it's phenomenal. We gave out tens of thousands of pieces of literature, and they were all asking, they were taking it home with them and reading it, and it's a massive revival.
Okay, and do you have a weekly meet-up, like a, you know, classic church?
No, we went down there, we were in the open air, we couldn't afford a building.
Okay.
Yeah, we did it like in the original Book of Acts.
Right, okay, so how does it go in the original Book of Acts then? What is the sort of different,
met in the open air before the churches, before churches were created by essentially Roman, and it was meeting in homes, house churches, and before that, they didn't even have that, just met in the open air.
Okay. Do you meet a lot of people who are Catholic who had a similar situation to you? And what do you say to Catholics?
Yes. Well, I tried to lead them out the same way I was led, by telling them about the Bible and how they must search for themselves and not just take what's been passed down, and not to worry about the Latin and all that, because, you know, it's a case of just finding out for themselves what the truth is. And, you know, Jesus said, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. So that's what I went for. That's what I found. And so I tell them the same as, it's the same way out for you as it was for me. Because if you stay in there, you'll never really know the full extent of what God has for you.
Okay. People might assume possibly that Ireland's a more religious place because they have a more heavily Catholic culture. But from what you've said, do you think England and Ireland are more or less religious than each other, or...?
No, I think Ireland is steeped in the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
And you have to think about the Catholic Church every move you make.
Okay, so ironically that might mean that a lot of people, less people possibly might get the
question on it. Yeah, because you're just following a set of rules laid down by Rome. And you're not to go outside them, you're not to think for yourself, and you're just to follow what you're told.
Okay, if anybody by this interview has sort of been struck as curious and they want to know more, Whereabouts can they find you, seeing as you don't have a...
Well, they can email us on bristolundergroundchurch@yahoo.co.uk.
Okay, Bristol Underground Church, all one word.
@yahoo.co.uk.
And of course, you can always look out for Simon Out and About. Do you go out on the streets as well?
We do, we go out together sometimes, yeah. We used to go to College Green quite a lot to meet the young people on the street. And
okay, well, he's just flashed his
just
back
so
to
they
the
know me, yeah.
Didn't work quite work radio, but the fluorescent jacket says Jesus Saves. You've also got some radio, your neck there saying Jesus is the answer as well. And you can pick up a booklet and chat to them if you see them. So, Simon and Bridget, thank you very much.
Thank you.
God bless.
Thank you very much to Simon and Bridget for coming in and sharing that with us.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now we've got a bit of music for you guys. Let's hear Ye Jacobites, written by Robert Burns.
Jacobites by name, Londoner, Londoner, ye Jacobites by name, Londoner, ye Jacobites by name, your faults I will proclaim, and your doctrines I must blame, and you shall hear, your doctrines I must blame. You shall hear what's right and what is wrong by the law, what's right and what is wrong by the law, what's right and what is wrong, a short sword and a long, a weak arm and a strong. Far to draw, a weak arm and a strong, far to draw. What makes heroic strife, fame to fire, what makes heroic strife, fame to fire? What makes heroic strife to wet the assassin? Knife or haunt a parent's life, we bloody war, or haunt a parent's life, we bloody war. Alone in the state, I let your schemes alone in the state. I'll leave your schemes alone, adore the rising sun, and leave a man alone to his fate, I leave a man alone to his fate. Jacobites by name, Londoner, Londoner, ye Jacobites by name, Londoner, ye Jacobites by name, your faults I will proclaim, and your doctrines I must blame, and you shall hear, your doctrines I must blame. Shall hear.
That was Eddie Reader singing you Jacobites from her album Songs of Robert Burns.
Bristol has one of the richest heritages of local history of any city in Europe, and in the 1980s, the Temple Local History Group began. Engineer, historian and author Julian Lee Jones is the author of the fascinating book Bristol Curiosities. Our Tony Gosling continues his conversations with Julian about Bristol's hidden history. This week, Julian talks about white slavery and Bristol's history as a base for attacking the Welsh and Bristol's famous Angel Fountain.
Bristol was used as another place to actually mount the forays against the Welsh, but as my name is Jones, I think this was most unjust. The Romans did. The Romans used Abonae, that's Sea Mills, as a staging post for attacking the Welsh. Even as late as the 18th century, St. James Fair, the Bristol merchant venturers had ships which they commissioned and manned to actually protect the merchants when they were sailing back from one of the big international trade fairs. People would come from Virginia and very far afield to actually buy goods at St. James. The corsairs and the other pirates used to lie in wait behind Steepholme and Lundy, and so we actually had to provide protection vessels. And the Danes came up the river and they actually took slaves, white slaves this is, from up as far up river as Bitton. It, in fact, became so bad at one stage that slaves were being taken over to Ireland and various other places. Bristol was known as the sort of stepmother of England, and the church was trying to stamp out this practice of selling the local population off to slavery.
You've got a chapter in your first book there about the Angel Fountain. Now, whereabouts was that, and what was it used for? What was the purpose of it?
On our intellectual and cultural forays to the pub in Broad Street, one of the things we'd notice in, one of Rhys Winston's books, it forms the cover picture, and it shows on the end of St. Nicholas Church an angel, a very elaborate angel, carved angel, holding open the Bible and with a newspaper seller in front of it, Evening Post or Evening World seller, I can't remember which. But there's nothing there now. It's just a sort of faint outline on the wall of this large sort of 6 foot, 7 foot high oval marble backing plate. What happened with the introduction finally of a potable water supply, which only came about when a lot of the Victorian workforce was dying off due to cholera. Bristol was one of the cholera black spots. Temple was as well. They were suddenly running out of Victorian workforce. Everybody got together and decided to do something about providing a decent water supply for most of the population. And the iron merchants and other people of Bristol got together to provide a series of drinking fountains, street fountains, because otherwise a lot of people, of course, had to get water from by water cellars by collecting buckets, hopefully from a water fountain, from the municipal water supply, which came from the Mendips, as opposed to just digging it out the river and sort of signing your death warrant then and there with the first sip. But anyway, the Angel Fountain was one of these. The iron merchants put up all these. Mr. Lang, who was trying to encourage his fellow merchants to do something about it, at a meeting in the sort of mid-19th century, sort of put £100 down on the table and said, right, that'll pay for one, you know, and the rest then followed suit. And there were dozens of fountains erected in the sort of first year. This one by the iron merchants was designed by Coalbrookdale. It was a standard Coalbrookdale pattern, and it was a large fountain. It was saying basically, whosoever from St. John, whosoever shall drink of me shall thirst no more, was whoever shall drink of this will continue to thirst. And I can remember even in the 1950s and 60s, there are still a few of these around the city, not the Angels, but other drinking fountains. And it also coincided with the temperance movement, because people drank beer because it was safer than drinking water. And, I mean, even the school teachers and the monitorial school system, where they used pupils to actually take on the teaching role, even the children then were paid in beer. So the temperance movement, what always struck me about this when we were researching this about the Angel Fountain, was that the vestrymen of St. Nicholas and all of the great and the good of the city, they celebrated the opening of this new fountain for the masses by having a champagne breakfast, which struck me as somewhat hypocritical, but they meant well, and it did result in lots of fountains appearing all around the city in the course of the next year or so.
Julian Lee Jones there was talking to Tony Gosling, and how easily we seem to forget about our local heritage. More local history from Julian next week. Temple Local History Group's website, if you're interested, is history4u.info. That's the word history, the number 4, and the letter U, history4u.info.
Another track now from Eddie Reader. It's called Willie Stewart, Molly Rankin. This song was written for Robert's good friend William Stewart. It was originally titled Who Scribbed on a Tumbler? Robert Burns is a diamond stylist and wrote these verses onto a crystal glass one night in celebration of his good friend. He wrote the last two verses for Willie's daughter, Polly Stewart. Eddie uses these verses to continue his tribute to Willie.
Bumpers high, express your joy. The bowl, we must renew it. The tappet hen guy, bring our Ben to welcome Willie Stewart. You're welcome, Willie Stewart. You're welcome, Willie Stewart. This narrow flower that blooms in me, the tap so welcomes thou art. Foes be strong and friends be slack, their action must they rue it. May women on him turn her back, the bring thee Willie Stewart. You welcome Willie Stewart, you welcome Willie Stewart. This ne'er a flower that blooms in me, the tap so welcomes thou art. Flower, it grows, it feeds, it falls, and nature cannot renew it. But worth and truth, eternal youth, we'll give to Willie Stewart. May she whose arms shall enfold thy charms possess a loyal and true heart. To her be given, to kin the heaven she holds in Willie Stewart. You're welcome, Willie Stewart. You're welcome, Willie Stewart. This ne'er a flower that blooms in me, the tap so welcomes thou art.
Welcome, Willie Stewart.
Oh, you're welcome, Willie Stewart. This ne'er a flower that blooms in me, the tap so welcomes thou art.
That was Eddie Reader singing a song by Robert Burns, Willie Stewart, Molly Rankin.
Railways were at the heart of Bristol's industrial past. Many thousands of commuters used rail every day to get to work. Before the beaching axe fell, Bristol had more suburban railway services that brought commuters to the city centre, certainly than we do now. Well, Philip Horton is presently compiling the second of two volumes entitled The Beaching Legacy right now. So if you have any old photos of our local railway network before the beaching axe fell, Philip wants to hear from you. So please send photocopies of any pictures or memorabilia that you have to his publisher, and I'll give you the address and phone number in a minute after we've heard from him.
You're looking at the second edition of this, which is going to be covering the Bristol and Bath area, being published probably in a year or so. You have a message for our listeners about photos to do with the railways, don't you?
Yes, I mean, there are a lot of photos published, many of them get published more than once. I'm rather looking for some new photographs to illustrate the lines that will be covered in Volume 2. They will include lines like the lines to Portishead, to Clevedon, to Severn Beach, Fish Ponds, Avonmouth, the Somerset and Dorset, or trains at any of the stations like St Anne's Park that were closed, or Yate, which closed and then opened again in the beaching report. So if anyone has got nice collections of photographs, if they'd like to and sent them in, then the best will be used in the book.
And what about your publisher?
It's a firm really that that concentrates on books of this sort. It's called the Nostalgia Collection from Silver Link Book. They're based up in the Midlands, which is not far from where I live now. They've done a big series called the Past and Present series, which shows what almost every station in the whole of Britain now they've covered, what it looked like when it was open, and what it looks like now, when some of them are bypasses, some of them are housing estates, some of them still have a railway but without the signal boxes and signals. So they've pretty well covered the country with those. So this is the sort of new approach, looking at it from the beaching angle. And each line in the that was closed gets a piece in the book. It gets a description, it gets a timetable, it gets some photographs, and it gets a little map. And so people could look and say, well, in 1963, I could have, there were 10 trains a day, which I could have used from my local station into Bristol or whatever.
Philip Horton there, talking to Dalek's Tony Gosling about his new book about railways in the South West. It's priced at £20, entitled The Beaching Legacy. If you have any other pictures, so just to recap, any other memorabilia from the days before the beaching axe, I hope you have your pen and paper handy. If not, you can always listen again to our podcast at dialectsradio.co.uk. The address to send photocopies of your photo to is as follows: Philip Horton, care of Silver Link Publishing, The Trundle, Ringstead Road, Great Addington, N for Norman, N for Norman 14, 4BW. So Silver Link Publishing, The Trundle, Ringstead Road, Great Addington, NN 14, 4BW. And the phone number for any inquiries about Philip or his book is 01536 330588. That's 01536 330588.
Now, a little tip for all of you out there who may be on pay-as-you-go mobiles. It's from Tony Gosling, our very own Dialect. If you are spending £10 or more a month on topping up your phone, there is a good chance that you'd be better off on one of the new contracts. Both Vodafone and O2 have what are called SIM-only contract deals, and that means basically replacing your SIM card but keeping your old number. Both firms are offering 300 minutes talk time a month, which is more than almost all pay-as-you-go users will need, and plus unlimited text for a year-long contract at £10 a month. So pop into your nearest mobile phone shop for more details on that one. Tony recommends phones for you rather than car phone warehouses. The staff tend to be more helpful. We have that on authority. This isn't an advert, just a money-saving tip from Dialect. And please be careful when using mobile phones, as the microwave radiation they give off can destroy or mutate your body cells, allegedly. Government guidance still recommends children should not use mobile phones. And if you or they have to, please use them on a loudspeaker and hold the phone away from your head. The upper half of the phone is generally where the microwaves are meant to be coming out. So if you want to know more about mobile phones and wireless network safety, and you're on the internet, please look up campaign group Masked Sanity. They're at masksanity.org. Or you can listen to Tony Gosling's hour-long interview with campaign director Sarah Wright in the archives of BCFM's Friday Drive Time at www.thisweek.org.uk. That's thisweek.org.uk.
Listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Conspiracy theories, love them or hate them, most of us have an opinion one way or the other. Investigative journalist and historian David Southwell has been doing his best to get to the bottom of some of the world's most elaborate enigmas. In Secrets and Lies, he confirms the old saying, the truth really can be stranger than fiction, when you take the time to dig out the hard facts behind the smokescreen of rumours and disinformation. David doesn't pretend to have all the answers, but he has applied an investigative journalist's eye to many riddles, modern and not so modern.
Secrets and Lies, drops from the fevered brow of David Southwell. What happens when something people in power do not want you to know about threatens to become public? They set up an official inquiry or other form of investigation to ensure a good old-fashioned whitewash, where lies are supported by a phalanx of selective facts and the truth is a secret buried in an unreported footnote. This might sound cynical, but any examination of the public inquiries, commissions, panels, committees and a host of other bureaucratic devices governments resort to when a public outcry is building shows they are rarely designed to reveal the truth. Those in power recognise an inquiry can not only calm public fears of a cover-up and draw the political sting out of an issue, but can also become a powerful mechanism for spreading the official version. If it is believed an inquiry is independent, the whitewash it produces can act as an enforcer of conformity and the orthodox view that reverberates throughout history. Although sold to the public as independent mechanisms for exposing secrets and lies, the nature of their composition, terms of reference, and limited investigative power means that, right from the word go, they will never produce a final report that reveals anything damaging to those who set up the investigation. The public rarely gets to see the hidden web of political patronage, shared interests and clandestine alliances that ensure that a supposedly autonomous commission has an invisible bias towards those in power or most at risk, should the full facts ever get out. On July 19, 1952, radar operators at Washington National Airport tracked an armada of blips on their screens, while through the glass in the control tower, their colleagues followed the fast-moving strange lights with their own eyes. The nearby Andrews Air Force Base, which also had the invaders of the US Capitol's airspace on their radar, scrambled attack jets. This set the pattern for the next 3 weeks. Mass sightings of UFOs confirmed by civilian and military radar contact, and fighters chasing UFOs over the White House itself. Not surprisingly, these events knocked the Korean War and approaching US presidential elections off the front pages. Occurring at the height of the Cold War, it is not surprising the UFO flap meant the public in Washington, D.C. were on the edge of hysteria. At the risk of losing all credibility for being unable to control the Capitol's airspace and unable to provide an explanation, the intelligence services formed the Advisory Panel on UFOs, Office of Scientific Intelligence. Headed up by physicist and CIA employee H.P. Robertson, the group of experts quickly became known as the Robertson Panel. However, instead of conducting a scientific and impartial investigation into what was happening in the skies above them, they quickly turned their considerable minds to conducting a whitewash that would calm top politicians' growing worries. Although unable to derive a conventional explanation that fitted the facts, the Robertson Panel reported that most UFO sightings were the misidentification of clouds, planets and stars, and the remaining cases could also be explained away if given enough study, even those that turned up on the radar. The panel also suggested the government should begin a program of serious debunking and run a secret public relations campaign using psychiatrists, astronomers and celebrities to reduce the public perception of UFOs as serious or threatening. They even suggested getting Walt Disney to help. Given this, it's not surprising that the US military got away with giving an official version that the events of 1952 were caused by a temperature inversion. In 1994, President Clinton faced a crisis when it emerged that the White House chief counsel, Bernard Nussbaum, had taken documents concerning the Whitewater Development Corporation from the office of Deputy White House Counsel Vince Foster when his dead body was found in Fort Macy Park. Bill and Hillary Clinton had invested in the property company and had been accused of fraud when the Securities and Exchange Commission investigated its bankruptcy. Facing a barrage of press speculation, Clinton did what most politicians in similar situations do. He called for an independent inquiry. Attorney General Janet Reno appointed a special prosecutor to investigate. When Kenneth Starr replaced original prosecutor Robert Fisk, the Clintons' allies claimed that the investigation was a witch hunt, while Hillary Clinton talked of a vast right-wing conspiracy. Using the classic tactics of refusing to cooperate and encouraging others to do the same, key witness Susan McDougall spent 18 months in jail for contempt after refusing Starr's questions. The inquiry dragged on until the public and press were bored. It was only when Starr discovered evidence of Bill Clinton's activities with Monica Lewinsky that the story was brought to life again. During this period, Clinton famously said, "I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky." Starr sent his report showing Clinton's perjury, obstruction of justice, witness tampering and abuse of authority to Congress. But in a total whitewash ignoring all of the evidence, the Democratic Party nominated Senate acquitted Clinton of all charges. In March 2002, Robert Ray, the third prosecutor appointed to the case, finally delivered his report. It showed that, after 8 years of investigation costing more than $52 million, Bill Clinton could have been charged and might have been convicted in a federal court for lying under oath and other offences. However, Mr. Clinton's lawyers struck a deal with Mr. Ray to spare the president from criminal charges the day before he left office in January 2001, ensuring a Whitewater whitewash to the end. When BBC journalist Andrew Gilligan reported in May 2003 that Tony Blair's government had sexed up its dossier of intelligence information about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction and probably knew that the claim the weapons could be launched in 45 minutes was wrong, everything changed. Within weeks, Gilligan's source for the report, government scientist Dr. David Kelly, was exposed in the press by the government and later found dead, apparently from suicide. And the BBC was under attack from Number 10. Gilligan was suspended, and Tony Blair established an inquiry under Lord Hutton to investigate the claims. After 6 weeks and £2.54 million in taxpayers' money, Hutton produced a report clearing the government of any responsibility for Dr. Kelly's death and suggesting that the accusations about the dossier were false. Even the normally loyal pro-Labour papers thought it was a whitewash. However, Blair demanded an apology. Gilligan left the BBC, as did its chairman and director general. A later inquiry by Lord Butler into the intelligence used to justify the war against Iraq showed just how much of a whitewash the Hutton inquiry had been. It proved that Tony Blair had lied when he twice claimed that Lord Hutton had seen all the intelligence on the case for war. It also showed that MI6 and the Joint Intelligence Committee knew intelligence had been withdrawn, but had not told this to Lord Hutton. Most importantly, it proved without a doubt that pressure had been brought by Number 10 to strengthen the report and that important caveats about the 45-minute claim had been removed. When the Butler report was published, Blair said he took full responsibility for any mistakes made, but claimed that they were made in good faith. According to Blair, no one lied. No one inserted things into the dossier against the advice of the intelligence services.
Was our weekly extract from the People's Spies non-dodgy dossier, David Southwell's book Secrets and Lies.
Have you ever fancied yourself as a singer? Now is your opportunity. Singers of any standard are being invited to join a mass choir for a concert in Bristol. If you've ever had a burning desire to perform on stage in a big venue, then this is your chance, whether you can sing well or not, according to Sing Live Southwest. The organisation has formed a new choir in the city and is looking to swell its ranks ahead of a November concert up in Clifton Cathedral. No auditions are necessary for the large choir, whose members are coached by a team of professionals, including Simon Curtis of the Welsh National Opera. They rehearse in Stoke Bishop for twice yearly concerts in the city, and many of the members also take advantage of performing in concerts and events in other areas. Recently, Sing Live singers have performed at the Royal Albert Hall, St Mark's Basilica in Venice, and at the Westminster Abbey Garden Party for the Lord Taverners Charity in the heart of London. Sing Live want new members to come forward in time for the concert at Clifton Cathedral, Saturday, November the 27th. Rehearsals start on September the 6th, so hurry, hurry, hurry. They're taking place at, once again, at Mary Magdalene Church, Mariners Drive, up in Stoke Bishop. The Clifton concert will feature inspirational and uplifting music in a gospel style, including some favourites such as Amazing Grace, Rivers of Babylon, Oh Happy Day, you can't have gospel without Oh Happy Day really, can you? And Something Inside So Strong, plus many classic others. So if you feel confident you're up for it, then auditions take place for solo parts as well. No experience is particularly required, but you do not need to be a music reader, as music is provided on CD in addition to the sheet music. So if you're still interested after hearing all of that and you're still up for it, visit singliveuk.com, or you can call 01609 780 315. And that number once again, 01609 780 315.
And carrying on the music theme, we've got some fantastic concerts to tell you about. Lunchtime Live at St Stephen's on St Stephen's Street, just in the city centre, a church there on Wednesdays, 10 past one, they've got a set of concerts going on. The first one, September the 8th, Michael Loder. It's called Storytelling with Improvised Trumpet, which sounds very interesting. Michael has worked as a storyteller in education with community groups and businesses for a long time, and he has a particular interest in Eastern European stories through a long association with Romania in the 90s. He co-founded the Festival of Fools, a group which explores intensively the role of the fool in releasing creativity and imagination, and he'll be accompanied by David Mowat playing trumpet in spontaneous response to the unfolding stories. Very, very interesting gig going up there. And September the 15th, Mark Darkside, he's a singer-songwriter, will also be at St Stephen's at 10 past one on Wednesdays. He's an avant-garde piano-based singer-songwriter whose songs combine theatricality and spiritual inquiry. Associated with the excellent Tuesday night monthly concerts at St Aidan's Church deep in East Bristol. So if you want more interest in that, take a look at their MySpace page at myspace.com/MarkDarkside. If you want to check out any of those concerts, the website to take a look at is www.st-stephens, that's a ph.com. They're Wednesdays, those concerts at 10 past one when they start, and they are at St Stephen's Church in St Stephen Street, just in the city centre.
Well, it's time as ever to introduce the What's On Guide, but Jeff Sparks, the man, is back in the hot seat himself. Did you have a happy holiday?
I did, thank you, John. Yeah.
Excellent.
Good afternoon. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio, starting with Thursday 9th of September, and the former vocalist of Wolfsbane and Iron Maiden, Blaze Bailey, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance and £10 on the door. Moving into Friday, 10th of September, Mad Sin will be performing with support from Control, the Speed Kings and Edsel Furies at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present The Lino. This is from their recent EP titled Connected, and it's a track titled Smile. The music video for this song has gained an online cult following and has brought in over 13,000 hits on YouTube.
This is dedicated to all the smiley people in the world. So whatever age, creed, colour, I want every single person to raise a smile. It's simple. And it goes. Forget the screw face, here's a new face. Tie the corners of your lips to your ears with a shoelace. Let me see the whitey yellow of your teeth shine. I'll work out for the mighty muscles on your cheek line. Stretching back the seam like you had a facelift. A golden opportunity, there's no need to waste it. A chance to ease the ties from your forehead. Live for the stresses of the world outside on your doorstep. A prize this prize as your lips will rise. To make an eclipse, one in between the dips of your eyes. The strangest surprise will occur in your neighbor. Vibe travels like illness. In a shelter more addictive than any drug sold on the corner, internationally supplied across all borders. What we're searching to see, what we're searching to own, is one in the same thing, but the method is known. It goes smile, push your cheeks back, do what I do. Smile, let your teeth shine, it's good for you. Smile, feel the vibe grow quick within this room, and we'll keep on smiling till the love consumes. Smile, push your cheeks back, do what I do. Smile, let your teeth shine, it's good for you. Smile, feel the vibe grow quick within this room. And we'll keep on smiling till the love consumes. 2, 3, and smile. Let the fabric of your face gain creases. Turn a frown upside down through the rumble of the speakers. I came to bring a yoga lesson for your features. Cheeks grow taunt like the freshest of peaches. Smile. Let the windows of your soul stand ajar. A band-aid for the wounds and untreated scars. If you're afraid, listen close, you're bound to laugh. Till ding, between your lips a showbiz spark. Smile. The universal signal for survival. Rich or broke, the light for the darkness. The prize for an artist when life is a hard stress. Lips prize and part, yes, creating the sparkles. Let the wobbies of the world melt away. Bring the glory to the world in your personal way. Smile, let it grow from the center of your soul. We're one and the same, and please let it be known. It goes smile, push your cheeks back, do what I do. Smile, let your teeth shine, it's good for you. Smile, feel the vibe grow quick within this room. And we'll keep on smiling till the love consumes. Smile, push your cheeks back, do what I do. Smile, let your teeth shine, it's good for you. Smile, feel the vibe grow quick within this room. And we'll keep on smiling till the love consumes. It goes smile. It goes smile. It goes smile, yes. It goes smile.
That was The Lino with Smile from the Connected EP. For more information, you can check out www.thelino.com. Into Saturday, 11th of September, in Wolf Parade, we'll be performing at the Thekla in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £12.50 in advance. Finally, on Sunday, 12th of September, Rick Payne and the Blues Cowboys will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Time for a bit of poetry. Hello, Tim Burrows.
Hi.
Well, you've got some news about a poetry festival coming up, if you're interested in that kind of thing. So we'll talk about that in a bit and give you some details at the end. But what have you got for us this week?
Well, I've got a poem about a poet and a poem about a sculptor, Rodin, because I've been trying to do some sculpture today, so I thought I'd do a poem. Bring this poet down about Rodin. He was the great French sculptor who kind of kicked off modern sculpture and recently saw his figures beside the Houses of Parliament, the burghers of Calais, walking, you know, amazing sculpture, bigger than life. Just incredible. Biggest hands you ever see, really. And feet.
Yeah.
So this is Rodin, sculptor of emotion in clay. Moulder of life, shaping clay into human form, with great hands strong to make gnarled feet of burghers, shouldering the weight of redemption to save their city. Moulding breasts and thighs, the crux of your temptation, daring the gods by making craven images so real that the salon judges thought them cast from life. To prove your skill, you sculpted figures larger and smaller than reality. Slender shoulders emerged from marble, the soft nape mantled with falling hair, the strong striding thighs of John the Baptist challenged the stylized kitsch of the salon, vibrant flesh frozen in bronze, smashed their ornamental dolls, returning sculptural art to the classical, anatomical greatness of Michelangelo's David. You cast your gates for the temple of art with the writhing flesh of Dante's tempted man, clawing through the mire of flesh, cast out carrying the bouquet of the fleur du mal, as you were tempted by the warm flesh of your beautiful models, reunited in the sexual psyche of Freud, vaulting like Michelangelo's heavenly saints, framed by angels, summoned for judgment. Naked and holy, born without sin, proud in innocence, clawing through clay to redeem yourself in stunning art that reaches out with the slender hands of prayer, appealing to the heavens for the soul in the clay of man.
Wow, what a poem. That was how recent is that?
That's 3 months ago. 3 months ago. I've been to his museum in Musée Rodin in Paris and actually missed a flight because I was there too long. So
how long did it take you to write that?
Probably about 2 weeks.
Okay.
But I'd been reading about Rodin, and so I tend to kind of put it all into the melting pot and then...
Yeah. Do you go pour over sort of each individual word in a sort of a Philip Larkin sort of way, like, you know, taking out one word and thinking, yes, you know, I've got to get it absolutely spot on, or do you just sort of get it out and then once it's out, you're sort of done and just move on?
I think I flow and then I pick out things I don't like. You know, and I think it's good coming to the programmes like this because I go through my stuff and I think, no, that's not good enough, that's that, you know,
yeah.
Check it out. And
different perspective.
Yeah.
Okay, so have you got another one?
Yeah, this is, given that we've got the Poetry Festival coming up this month, this is for Emily Dickinson. I wrote a biography of hers and then wrote a poem about her. And she was so modern in her writing, yet she was writing at the time of the American Civil War.
Mm.
So this is a little woman in a white dress, shut in with words, moulding them with capitals and dashes, sewing fascicles together, hoarding them in your bedroom closet, peering through your door to witness your father's funeral, an unknown passion lived through letters, hidden in the mirrors of poems, holding your own in a man's world, keeping your own religion against the pressure of your peers, you built your heaven in words. Your loneliness was stitched in letters, cross-tatched and embroidered with delicate waif-like phrases, you reached out to the world with your pages. Cross the ages with your unique voice, modern yet cradled in the American Civil War. An icon of solitary strength, a caged bird who sang to the wind, whose song was heard around the globe. An embroidered quilt patterned for a soul, sepulchred in seclusion, filling your bedroom drawer with words. White calico, your emblem, fastened with a flower, framing your capitals. You caught them unawares. Cloistered in the grand porched house, war raged at your door, yet your words portrayed your search for God and passion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if you've had your lexical taste buds tickled there by the poetry and you are interested in the Poetry Festival, it takes place on Friday the 10th of September at the Lansdowne Pub, which is in Clifton Road in Clifton. It's at 8 p.m. Friday the 10th of September, just to say that again. It's £5 to get in. If you want to contribute and you're interested in reading some poetry, you can chat to Trevor when you're there, or you can phone him in advance on 0117 966 5514. That's 966 5514. And that's just one of many events that are taking place at the Poetry Festival. There's a whole range of stuff going on. So if you're interested in that and you want to look up something on the web, you can put in to your favoured search engine Poetry Can, all one word, Poetry Can and Bristol. And that will bring you up all sorts of stuff about the Poetry Festival. Wonderful. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Radio is a weekly podcast for your MP3 players, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM across Bristol, 12 noon every Sunday. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed, which will remind you every Thursday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download our podcast from dialectradio.co.uk.
You can also find a lo-fi mono version of Dialect for dial-up connections at bristol.indymedia, and indie is with a Y, .org every Friday morning. Or if you're outside Bristol, you can listen live on the internet at bcfm.org.uk.
Thanks to our studio guests this week. We had Simon and Bridget, and Tim Burrows came in to read a poem. Reporters this week were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and The What's on Guard was by Jess Sparks. Studio production this week was by Lee Duffield and Michael Noyes, and the producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find also on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk.
Well, that was Dialect Radio, and I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I was Michaela Dennis, wishing you a very good week. From all the team in our Queen's Square studio in Bristol City Centre, thank you for listening, and until the same time next week, goodbye.
But it's warm and light, and I can almost sense a little confidence. But I've been sitting here too long, going over all the things I've done, but I can feel the time. Doesn't feel like mine, but all things change. I've been holding on too tight, I've been clinging on for my dear life, but it don't